Concluding today a series on aligning our hearts with the mission of the Father. And we've had some wonderful things that have been shared along the way in personal testimonies. I know you've been encouraged by that. I've heard so many good things about it. And most of those who have testified have given permission for it to be posted online. So if you missed any of that, you want to check it out because they've had some really good reports to give on what the Lord's been doing in their life. But as we close out this series, there's an issue we need to look at, and it may be just a little uncomfortable, and it's the notion of love. Now, if you start asking people, what is love, you get a variety of answers. So I thought I would collect some of them and just walk us through them. When someone says, what is love? What do people respond? Well, love is when you wait for a message from someone. Love is when you wait for someone to come online. That sounds very contemporary, doesn't it? Love is when you think of someone all the time. Love is when you want to be with someone. Love is being safe with someone. Love is being comfortable with someone. Love is the language of feelings. Or, if you ask someone else, you know, I should probably mention that for some of these young people, they would probably agree with what's been said. But some of us older folks, we might tend to think of what we've just read as more infatuation or sexual attraction, but we'll let them sort that out as they age. What is love? It's a widely misunderstood, although highly desirable malfunction of the heart, which weakens the brain, causes eyes to sparkle, cheeks to glow, blood pressure to rise, and the lips to pucker. Once again, well. Or some of us who've been hanging around for a while and listening to sermons on love and listening to Grandma lecture on life, we might say that love never gives up. Love cares more for others than for itself. Love doesn't want what it doesn't have. It doesn't strut, doesn't have a swelled head, doesn't force itself on others, isn't always me first, doesn't fly off the handle, doesn't keep score of the sins of others, doesn't revel when others grovel. It takes pleasure in the flowering of truth, puts up with anything, trusts God always, always looks for the best, never looks back, but keeps going to the end. Blah, blah, blah. Words. We try to talk about a concept and we get lost in the feelings of the concept. Paul makes this instruction in 1 Timothy 1:5. He says, but the goal of our instruction is love from a pure heart, a good conscience, and sincere faith. Love from a pure heart. Now, much of what gets expressed in love in this culture today is neither that nor is it from a pure heart. But when the Lord starts talking about how we are to represent Him, He goes after this. And yet, words are just words until we can find some way in life to identify what might love look like. Let me read you a story. This is an actual account reported by the New York Times online from a real situation that's ongoing right now in Kabul, Afghanistan. In the dank basement on the outskirts of Kabul, Joseph read his worn blue Bible by the light of a propane lantern as he's done for weeks since he fled from his family in Pakistan. His few worldly possessions sat nearby in the 10-by-10-foot room of stone and crumbling brown earth. He keeps a wooden cross with a passage from the Sermon on the Mount written on it, a carton of SA cigarettes, and a thin plastic folder containing the records of his conversion to Christianity. The documents are the reason he's hiding for his life. On paper, Afghan law protects freedom of religion, but the reality here and in some other Muslim countries is that renouncing Islam is a capital offense. Joseph's brother-in-law, Ibrahim, arrived in Kabul recently, leaving behind his family and business in Pakistan to hunt down the apostate and kill him. Reached by telephone, Ibrahim, who uses only one name, offered a reporter of the New York Times $20,000 to tell him where Joseph was hiding. If I find him, once we're done with him, I will kill his son as well, because his son is a bastard, Ibrahim said, referring to Joseph's three-year-old child. He is not from a Muslim father. For Joseph, age 32, who asked his identity only by his Christian name to protect his wife and young child, the path to Christianity was only one segment on a much longer journey, a year of wandering that took him through Turkey, Greece, Italy, and Germany, seeking refuge from Afghanistan's violence. But at each stop, he found misfortune. He was detained in Greece and deported from Germany. He lived on the streets in Italy before he truly understood that there would be no happy ending in Europe, where his application for asylum has gone nowhere. He voluntarily left Italy for Pakistan to be with his wife and son, but that is no longer an option. Neither is reverting to Islam. I inherited my faith, he says, but I saw so many things that made me discard my religious beliefs. Even if I get killed, I won't convert back. In official eyes here, there are no Afghan Christians. The few Afghans who participate in the faith do so in private for fear of persecution, attending one of a handful of underground churches that are believed to be operating in the country. Expatriates use chapel on embassy grounds, but those are effectively inaccessible to Afghans. Only a few Afghan converts have surfaced in the past decade, and the government has typically dealt with them swiftly and silently. They're asked to recant, and if they refuse, they're expelled, usually to India, where an Afghan church flourishes in New Delhi. In a country of crippling poverty, ethnic fault lines, and decades of war, Islamic piety offers many Afghans a rare thread of national solidarity. To reject Islam is seen as tantamount to treason. Religious identity is the only thing that Afghans can claim, a professor at the American University in Afghanistan states. They do not have a national identity. They do not have an economic identity. There is no middle or working class here. This leaves Joseph almost nowhere to turn for protection. The police would be of no help. Converts report being beaten and sexually abused while in custody. His family in Afghanistan is also a dead end. His uncles are hunting for him now. Joseph said he lost his faith well before he knew what would replace it. Most of his siblings immigrated to Germany when he was a teenager, but he stayed behind to look after their ailing, aging parents. He drove a taxi at night and studied medicine, earning a degree from Kabul Medical University. He hung on through civil war, repressive Taliban rule, and Western invasion. But a senseless shooting he witnessed at close range in 2009 that left an 8-year-old boy dying in his mother's arm finally shattered his resolve to stay. He borrowed money from his family, worked double shifts until he could pay a smuggler to get him to Europe. He left behind his mother, who died soon afterwards, and his pregnant wife, who moved to Pakistan to be with her family. His memory of the journey are flashes of elation and despair, the sights of Istanbul, the fence at the Turkish-Greek border with fingers laced in the wire, a field of sunflowers, 3 sickening days on rough seas on a boat to Italy and a last-minute swim to shore, a road trip to Germany using the passport of a Pakistani who looked nothing like him, and the desolate Hamburg street where his brothers picked him up. In Hanover, close to where his siblings lived, Joseph found a Protestant church for Farsi speakers and began attending services at first just to watch. When I threw away my Islamic beliefs, I was living in a space of spiritual emptiness. During that time, I was studying different religions, Buddhism, Hinduism, and Christianity. I was studying Islam as well. After 15 days in Germany, he turned himself in and applied for asylum, was held in a refugee camp where the monotony was broken by visits from missionaries. I think I was impressed by the personality of Jesus himself, he said. The fact that he came here to take all of our sins, that moved me. I admired his character and personality long before I was baptized. When he was released to live with his sister in Kassel, He returned to the church in Hanover and converted, a decision his siblings accepted with open-mindedness. The reprieve was short-lived. The German authorities arrested him and deported him to Italy because he had not sought asylum in the European Union country where he was first processed as required. Without friends or family in Italy, he sought aid from churches and charities that offered him food but no shelter. Homeless, broke, depressed, and deteriorating in health, Joseph gave up and went to live with his wife and family in northern Pakistan. Knowing the stakes of his secret, he put digital copies of his asylum paperwork and mementos of his conversion and baptism on a flash drive he carried in his pocket, finding some comfort in having them with him. But one day in March, he left the flash drive at home. While he ran errands, one of his wife's brothers borrowed the flash drive to save a file and discovered what was on it. When Joseph came home that evening, his in-laws grabbed him by the throat and beat him. We tied his hands and legs and we wanted to kill him, Ibrahim said. It was my father who intervened and said he wanted to talk to his family first. The father said they would contact Joseph's uncles for guidance, and in the meantime, Joseph would be locked in a room at the side of the house, bound hand and foot. In the middle of the night, Joseph managed to escape, sneaking out of the house without a final goodbye to his wife or son. He caught a night bus to the border of Afghanistan. On the way, he phoned a childhood friend to ask for help, and then he called his sister in Germany, weeping into his cell phone. Reached in Germany, his sister, who declined to be named for fear of giving a clue to her brother's pursuers, said she hasn't heard from Joseph since then. "I've been worrying about his life and his whereabouts," she said. "It will be one of the biggest achievements of my life if I can help him get somewhere that he can practice his new religion openly." To aid a convert is nearly as despised here as to be one, but his friend helped him anyway, hiding him in the basement of an empty house and bringing him food once a week. "When times were good, he was always generous with me," said his friend, who spoke on the condition of anonymity because of the danger. "Now he's at risk and needs my help, and I have no choice but to give it." For Joseph, who has recently changed hiding places, the time slowly passes with little company other than his Bible. He can hear the muezzin calling Muslims to prayer, a reminder of the danger and the proximity and the paradox in which he now lives. "When I threw my convictions away, it was hard to speak with people about it," he said, a red ember pulsing on the tip of his cigarette. "It was like an imaginary prison," he paused, the light from his propane lantern casting a long shadow on the wall. "Now it's the other way around. My body is in prison, but my soul is free." Maybe it's just me, but that doesn't sound like love to me. You need to somehow come to grips with what people who don't live in this country are paying to confess Jesus Christ as Savior. It is a sobering, sobering thing. Now, when a family, your own family, your uncles, your brother-in-laws, are committed to killing you for converting to Christianity, you can appreciate why things seem to have a facade of solidarity. But any of you who have ever faced fear know that fear can control you externally, but it may not reign over you internally. You learn to play the game in order to survive. That's not freedom. "Now my body is in prison, but my soul is free." Jesus does that. Now, for the last several weeks, we have been hearing testimonies from first-generation Christians. Now, by first-generation, I mean this. They're the first to come in. And the stories they have been telling have been littered with the calamities of life, near death and incredible brokenness and fatherlessness and on and on and on. Back in the early charismatic movement, there was an organization that I believe is a good organization. But one of the things that happened during those days was this. They would find and promote the most unusual stories of conversion. Hit men, wheel men for the mob who got converted, and strippers who got converted, and prostitutes who got converted, and crooked Wall Street people who got converted. And by the time they were through telling their stories, and the stories went on and on and on, we were coming to a place where those of us who didn't come from that kind of chaos felt like we didn't have a story to tell. When you hold up the standard of scandalous behavior, outrageous dysfunction, as the basis of giving a testimony, then what do those of us who didn't grow up in that have to say? See, there's always going to be first-generation Christians because Jesus is interested in redeeming all. He's not willing any should perish. He died once for all men. So consequently, we're always going to hear that. But God's agenda, the Father's agenda, is to reconcile those heirs lost to Him to Himself and have fourth, fifth, and sixth generation of righteous testimonies. I'm grateful anytime somebody comes to the Lord, has their sins forgiven, and we start to watch that wonderful transformation practice that we see and hear about around here all the time. But look, there needs to be somebody telling the story that my life wasn't all that hosed up and Jesus found me anyway. We have such a story today. Welcome, Al Hernandez.
Thank you. Good morning, everyone. This is a testimony of an average Joe. Okay. I grew up in a Catholic church. I was born in Colombia, South America, the firstborn of three children to well-to-do parents. My dad was an international banker for the Canadian Royal Bank. My mom was an assistant to the president of the soccer league, one of the Colombian's professional soccer teams. So by standards in a Colombian country or a third world nation, they were well off. You know, we had servants to tend to our needs. But I don't want you to get the wrong idea. My parents left behind what they thought was a better place for, you know, come to the United States. So we left Colombia in the 60s, where my dad thought it was just a difficult situation. He went from wearing a suit and tie to work to wearing jeans and heavy boots. And in a textile factory. My mom made the same sacrifice. She was a seamstress. And I can't read anymore.
She was a seamstress in a sweatshop.
All the while, my parents never lost their faith. Always continued to go to church. As a young man, my dad always had me by his side. He was always teaching me a lesson. I remember sitting at the kitchen table. As he sat at the kitchen table, I sat to his right. And as he worked on the household income and worked through those issues, or the one evening or one afternoon we went to a protest because the union had a strike. It was a very cold, bitter day, but he had to stand there as part of, you know, do the right thing, what it was right. There was one evening I came home, and it was in high school. I came home from high school party, and I was drunk. So my dad helped me to bed. the next day, we just had a long conversation to discuss the consequences and decisions I've made that night before that could have affected my life. As you can tell, I grew up in a caring and loving environment. Through high school, through grade school, especially high school, my parents get me involved in activities, as many activities as possible, because they would just keep me out. Basically, their thought was that I would stay out of trouble, and I did. It was just a difficult situation. I went to a, if you can recall, a movie called Lean on Me, thank you, with Morgan Freeman. Okay, that's the high school I graduated from. Okay. Well, I went to that high school. I'm sorry, I didn't graduate from there. My parents kept me involved in baseball, football, and all other activities. And I did not realize the craziness that was around me. Midway through my junior year, my parents asked my uncle, who lived in Miami, to take me in until my dad and the rest of the family could move down to Miami, because the conditions in my school had worsened. In my senior year is where I met my love, Alexia. She was a college freshman at the local community college and the manager of a jewelry store where I look for Christmas work. And, well, that's another story. Upon graduating, I went to a recruiter station to join the Air Force, but saw that the line was too long, so I joined the Navy in the Dell Entry Program. That turned out well, somewhat. In a short few months, I knew Alexia was the one. She continues to be the love of my life. My delay entry program was coming to an end. I was to report from my first duty station, boot camp, A school, and off to Sicily I went. When I got there about dark 30, I was completely out of my element. But as you know, the Lord has always been there. I was met by the duty driver, which also happens to be my future roommate. And more than I can ever thank him for, I would listen to him praying in the evenings directly to God, which I was not accustomed to. This is probably the first time I can recall hearing a heartfelt prayer without somebody reciting the rosary. During my deployment, Alexia and I planned our weddings via letters, not email. And we were not even engaged. How crazy was that? As a Catholic, I did my good deeds and moved on in life. I did not lack his love. I had a wonderful life with my new wife, Alexia. As they saw ignorance in bliss, one Easter morning we attended a Catholic church where Candace was newborn and Calvin was just Candace was about 9 months old and Alexia was about 9 months pregnant. We realized that we needed some change and stuff. Well, Alexa goes to work the following day, and she's the manager of a paging company. Back then, we had pagers. Then a gentleman walked in, which was a new pastor of a church looking for some paging service. So Alexa helped him with what he needed, and he invited us or her to attend his church. So we attended the church. I wasn't too, thrilled about the singing and the tongues and all that stuff. But it was interesting. Several months later, I attended a Carmen concert, and that's where I met the Lord. I'm going to give you a couple key points of my life that just real brief that I know the Lord had his hands in. I was driving home as I was approaching red light, and the light turned green, So I went back to the accelerator in my car, and I heard a voice clearly say, "Stop." In an instant, I moved my foot from the accelerator into the brake pedal and stopped the car as it lurched forward. Because of the momentum, I was not able to, prior to entering the intersection, but it just enough to prevent me from getting hit by the car that took the light. Alexia and I were, this is another one, Alexia and I were youth leaders. We took a week-long trip with our teen group. It was a hot summer Florida day, and our old broken-down bus broke down an isolated stretch of road, and smoke billowing from under the hood. We managed to pull over the bus. Alexia took most of the kids away off the side of the road, and the two older ones stayed with me. One of the radiator hoses were torn near the clamp. I was able to cut the hose and make the repair. Okay. Here comes the amazing part. When I finished putting the bus back together, we still didn't have enough fluid or water to put in the radiator. And so I noticed Alexia and the kids were also praying. And at the moment, while a white panel delivery truck drives by, pulls up in front of us. As I walk towards the truck, a guy comes out of the truck and pulls two 2-gallon jugs of water and says, "This is what you'll need to get there." In my excitement, I took the jugs from him, walked towards the bus, but then turned back around to say thank you, and he was gone. And this one, Lightning laughs at me all the time. I was coming to my end of my naval career. I knew Alexia and the kids. Sacrificed a lot while I was on deployment. But I knew that the end was coming. So when I put my retirement paperwork in, I've had this job for 23 years, didn't know anything different. So I was very apprehensive. Alexa would use other words. I did not have a formal college education. When I retired, I did not know if I was marketable. I did not know how to support my family. So for almost a year, I was lost. As you know the Lord, he shows up again. Several months prior to my retirement, I was offered a job without a resume, without applying, for almost twice as much as my salary.
Every story is meaningful. Every story matters. Your story is important because it says things about your God, the attending details of your life, when you didn't even recognize his hand upon you. Catholic family, Columbia, back in the day when Colombia was a dangerous place to live, much more so than today. A father makes a decision to surrender the life he knows and the lifestyle he has acquired for the sake of someone he loves. Trades in his suit for working boots and a factory. Mom leaves a prestigious, highly publicized position to become a seamstress in a sweatshop. What does love look like? For God so loved you, He gave the best that He had for you. So Jesus comes along and starts talking to us about the things upon which we set our affections. He says things like this: no one can serve two masters, for either you will love the one and hate the other, or you will cling to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and wealth. You cannot serve your father and cling to the notion of self-provision. Because when your father comes into the picture, he supplies everything that you need according to his riches in glory. And our faith walk is about surrendering our ability to provide for us to his promise to make provision for you. And if you can't make that transition, you can never fully love the Lord because you never fully trust Him. Never confuse the source with the channel. The channel can change, but the source remains the same. He is your Father. So whatever the circumstances are that will unfold and they will change, who are you going to look to? You've got to make the decision ahead of time because he'll train you along the way. And if you refuse to make the decision now, you won't be ready when the crisis comes. Jesus goes on to say, he who loves his father or mother more than me is not worthy of me, or his son or his daughter. Now, he's not saying don't love your father, don't love your mother, don't love your son, don't love your daughter. What he's saying is, in the pecking order of priorities of relationship, I am supreme. Why? Because he is God. He is the eternal Father. And even in the law, which has been transcended by his resurrection, the law says, love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. And he is saying, I am the priority of your affections if you're going to be effective. In his speaking about the things we are to love, he says, if you are one of those who loves your life, I promise you, you're going to lose it. But if you will lose your life for my sake, you will keep it forever. You know, I have run into people on many occasions who were afraid to give their heart to the Lord because he might require them to change the way they were living. The way you were living is the reason you needed the Lord. When the Lord talks about love, he goes on to say things like this: he who has my commandments and keeps them. Pay attention to this. Do you love the Lord? Be careful.
Yeah.
Do you obey him?
Well, I love him.
Kinda. Occasionally. When it's convenient. When it's something I really want to do. Project warrant? Nah, that's not me. I don't love like that. Hope? Nah. Soup kitchen? Nah. Beach? Meditating? Yeah. He who has my commandments and keeps them, these are the ones who love me. And if they love me, they'll be loved by my Father. And I will love them, and I will continue to give them revelation of myself. I sure hope you want a bigger Jesus than the one you've got right now. I sure hope there are things about him you still want to discover. But there are some things you cannot know apart from obeying the very things you know he has asked you to do that you have continued to refuse to do. Am I talking to the right people? When he speaks about the kind of love, he says, you have heard it said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I say to you, what does he say? Love your enemies. Now, how in the world are you going to do that?
I don't even like my enemies.
That's because we do not yet have love from a pure heart. When he sets this challenge before us, do you think that a soul will be frustrated in a foolish attempt to try to accomplish it? Or is he actually suggesting that there's an area outside our comfort zone he wants to lead us into so we can begin to experience more of what he actually represents? You've heard it said, love your friends and hate your enemies. But I say to you, love your enemies. Now, do you think that means we're just going to sit here and say, oh, I love those poor ISIS boys. I love those Taliban. Or does it have to be demonstrated? Now, one of the wonderful things about America is that the Christian foundation of this country has precipitated compassionate benevolence throughout our maturation process as a country. I was so proud of us following a destructive tsunami in the South Pacific, where the Muslims agreed to not attack us for 30 days while we offloaded food for them and their people. Am I the only one that can see the contradiction? See, there's something about what the Lord does that truly allows us to overcome evil with good, even when evil cannot see the good, but only sees the self-provision that they negotiate. We are challenged to love in a very, very particular and peculiar way. The Lord says, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you. But he also says this, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. How would you love your neighbor as yourself? What would you do for you? Would you feed you? Would you clothe you? Are we thinking yet? And so when we look around at the homeless or the Project Warm people, or the other opportunities that just come right in our face, do we excuse ourselves from it? I remember a very pivotal moment in my life. It was just a little incident that just so exposed me to me in a way I didn't want to be. Mahesh and I were somewhere in Asia, Hong Kong or Taiwan or someplace. And these two little girls in uniform, probably, 10 to 13, somewhere there, they come running up to solicit a donation for something. Now, back in those days, I had reached a fairly well-developed sense of cynicism about being hustled for things I didn't know anything about. And so I immediately felt my heart close and me try to step away from them. He immediately reached into his wallet, gave him a donation. They pinned a little flower indicating, don't hit this one up again, he's already given. But the contrast between his generosity and my cynicism was one of those snap. Anybody ever showed you a picture of you eating? Don't you wish they would ban pictures of you chewing on something? Or those are not flattering pictures. You don't want to see those. But that snapshot in that moment has stood with me to this day and increased the generosity that flows out of my financial well-being. as the Lord shows you things about you that pull up that little photograph that you don't want to see, He's doing you a favor, calling your attention to something that He'd like you to pay attention to with Him so that who He is can occupy what you were. And it's a wonderful process after the fact. You know, when the lawyer came to Jesus testing Him, he said, "Rabbi, what is the greatest commandment in the law?" Is that the question he asked? What is the greatest commandment in the law? What did Jesus say?
I don't know. I'm just going to sit here and mumble noise.
Love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind. And in Mark's version, because he was writing to the Greeks, he had, "and with all your strength." And the second is like unto it. Love your neighbor as yourself. Upon this, these two commandments hang all the law and the prophets. Now, you will still hear Christians saying, "You're supposed to love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, your neighbor as yourself." A lawyer stood up to test him on the basis of the law, and he answered according to the law. Does Jesus trump the law? So that is not the standard for the people of God. That's the standard of the law. There is a harder standard for the people of God. The harder standard is this. Behold, I give you a new covenant, a new commandment, that you are to love one another as I have loved you. That's a lot harder than the law. How did Jesus love you? He surrendered the right to rule his own life so that another could live and rule through him. I only do what I see my Father doing. The words I speak to you are not my own words. It is the Father speaking. The command that He gives us is a fully yielded expectation where we have surrendered our right to represent us so that He can live through us representing Him. And in that, He says, as I have loved you, not how I'm going to love you when I go to the cross, but how I have already demonstrated to you that I put others ahead of me. All this month, I have been trying to awaken us to what it means to realign our heart with the Father's mission. And I've tried very hard to stay away from the word evangelism. I've tried very hard to ignore that word, because the moment somebody uses that word, all the baggage associated with that language pops up in your file. But when we talk about the lost, we're talking about family members who have not yet come home to the Father. Those who occupy spheres in which you have influence. Those who will hear your voice, watch your acts of kindness, respond to you. I am accustomed to being out there in environments where they say, "Can we talk for a minute?" And this was not with me wearing a cleric thing. It was the difference of who I was in the midst of those they knew. Do you understand? Mahesh told me a story this weekend that I had never heard before. But it so illustrates things I've said to you over and over again. When he was a young, struggling graduate school student, a young Christian Hindu who had been renounced by his family for abandoning their faith, living at a survival level, he heard about an Episcopalian in the city of Santa Fe, who was doing some kind of conference about the Holy Spirit. And the Lord was awakening him to that realm, so he purchased a bus ticket and was headed those many long hours. Now, back in those days, he was young and thin and meek and an alien, a foreigner in Texas, a brown-skinned guy, you know what I'm saying? So he's sitting all the way in the back of the bus. And as the bus moves along, it wasn't an express bus. It was the every ditch and every telephone pole had to stop. And as they moved through the afternoon into the evening, things got very, very black. Darkness overtook everything. So there was just him and this monstrous man seated about halfway up. A guy who was huge, tattooed, and looked like he had just destroyed a biker gang, who kept glancing back at this young, frail Indian boy sitting in the back of the bus. And the bus is moving on into the darkness, and the guy keeps looking back and staring. Feel the tension? Finally, the guy gets up, walks back, looks down, says, "Can I sit next to you?" My little Indian friend said, "Yes." And the guy turned to him and said, "Who are you?" See, he quickly said, "Lord, who am I?" And the Lord said something to him that has defined his entire life. The Lord said, "Tell him, you're a servant of the Most High God." And so he said, "I'm a servant of the Most High God." He said, "I was sure there was something different about you, because you glow in the dark." "I kept looking back because you are shrouded in light. I am just out of prison, 14 years worth. I tried to kill myself 2 days ago." He held up his bandaged wrist. He said, "I have no idea where my wife and children are in this country. And I have no hope." Mahesh says, "Well, Jesus will give you hope. All you need to do is ask him to forgive you of your sins. Come in and make you a new man." As he began to pray that prayer, he burst into singing in tongues. When those moments passed, he looked at him and said, "I have hope." They left the bus, went their separate ways, never seen one another again. You glow in the dark. But you need to be ready to say where that light is coming from. As we give ourselves away, even when they are resisting us, it takes time to erode some of the defenses that people have. It takes time for them to believe you're actually what you are. They will ask you, "Why are you doing this? Why don't you just leave me the explicative alone?" "I can't, because there's something in me from the God I serve that cares about you." They're all sitting on a dark bus someplace without hope. Our problem is we've been taught to pretend to love rather than truly love. We go and we take baskets of food on Thanksgiving and we drop a track in it. Love with a hook in it. We go visit somebody in the hospital, just strangers, hoping we'll get a shot to bring them to Jesus. We befriend our neighbor so we can bring them to Jesus. I don't have any problem visiting the hospitals, giving food. I don't have any problem with that. I've got a problem with the fact that we use that as an excuse to try to score. Pure love serves because of love. And we influence regardless of the response. Because we carry something that glows in the dark. And we have a representation for which we are accountable to our Father to put Him on display. And what He does is He draws them to Himself. And if Himself is on display through us, you get to be there when He and they meet face to face. Can you hear my heart in this? We've got to serve. We've got to do that. But we need to serve from the motive of love, not what it's going to get us. When you hear me talk about investing in the kingdom, I'm not talking about that so that we'll get more people sitting in this house. I'm talking about investing Jesus everywhere we go. That is love from a pure heart. And you don't know where that will take you. But I can tell you after these 40-something years, it is an interesting journey. I wouldn't want to miss it. I don't know what's yet ahead. You know, T-boned in the intersection today or dying in my sleep 25 years from now. But whatever time I got left, I want to see Jesus do something cool. Would you stand? I don't know what it is you have in your heart that the Lord has been asking you to do in obedience to Him. I don't know what sphere of influence you have or those who are already wondering about you. They come to you with these little questions just to see how you're going to handle them. They'll come at you with accusations to see if you're going to react like the last one they accused of being a phony. But if we live before the Lord in their presence, they will see us living in His presence before the Lord. And in that, He does His magic. As we move forward into the holiday season, you're going to have an opportunity to be with friends and family, office parties, etc. What will they see? What will they hear? What will you be? I encourage you, as we head forward into 2015, we become so much more clear in who it is we have been caused to become. And let who that person is be enough in your dynamic. Father, I bless these dear, dear people you have worked so diligently and so long to bring to yourself. So many of us here have stories, Lord, and you are the climax of every story. Whether it's bringing us 2 gallons of water for a dry radiator or if it's causing us to sit on a dark bus and glow, you are the one who's made the difference in our life. I pray, Lord, that you will awaken our hearts afresh to how needy those we know really are, even when they can't yet see it. Help us, Lord, to walk above offense. Help us to walk in grace. Help us, Lord, to speak gentle words. Help us to have a truly comforting spirit. And above all, Lord, you've given us your nature. Now express it in purity through our hearts to those under the sound of our voice and the sphere of our influence for your glory and their lives through us. In Jesus' name, amen. If you're here this morning and you need to come to Christ for the first time or renew your commitment to Him, I encourage you to get that done before you leave. Our first-time guests, we welcome you to the hospitality room out in the lobby to the left. The altar is open, and we're happy to pray with you. You are dismissed.